There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
You're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our condensed, economically efficient wrap-up of what's been happening on the programme.
We'll look at some of our favourite stories in a few moments' time. First of all, quick recap of our business headlines.
Dubai Eye 103.8 Business Headlines.
In association with insurancemarket.ae.
The UAE is the world's seventh most competitive economy, according to a new ranking from the IMD World Competitiveness Council. It's up three places from last year. The US, Hong Kong and Singapore lead the list.
A new committee is being set up to decide which industries here in the UAE will be included in the new 100% foreign ownership law. That's according to Abdullah Al Saleh, Undersecretary for Foreign Trade and Industry at the Ministry of Economy.
And Ramadan should see increased retail spending, according to YouGov. New research shows that 40% of UAE consumers think the season is the best time to make purchases because of good offers.
Dubai Eye 103.8 Business Headlines.
In association with insurancemarket.ae. Compare insurance for your car, health, home or business with insurancemarket.ae.
One of the more interesting stories that's caught our attention this morning is this. Because Robbie Williams will actually be partying like a Russian this weekend.
This is really controversial because that song is not particularly well loved in parts of Russia. It's considered to be a parody of oligarchs and Russian excess. Some people consider it to be a parody of Vladimir Putin himself. Robbie Williams denies this, but the fact that he's being invited to perform at one of the flagship events in Russia's calendar is weird. How is this happening, Brandy?
So today, Thursday, Russia's version of the World Economic Forum kicks off. It's a three-day event. It takes place in St. Petersburg. It's the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. And the great and the good will all be there. The people that we know will be at the forum, not necessarily at the after party where Robbie Williams is performing, include Emmanuel Macron, the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, Christine Lagarde, and others. Now, Robbie Williams has been hired to perform at what's largely considered to be the unofficial after party. It's a party being thrown by a Russian billionaire and the Arsenal shareholder,
Alexander Usmanov.
Yes, he holds this party every year, and this year he has hired Robbie Williams. I'd love to know how much money he's getting.
I would want to be a fly on the wall in there when that happens as well. And will he play that song?
You couldn't. Could you?
We'll find out. Sunday morning, listen to the Business Breakfast. Some of the other stories we're covering today. We like the new IMD competitiveness survey that came out overnight, broke at midnight. The UAE brand has done really, really well. We were 10th last year, top 10. That is good. This year, we're 7th. Now, we've got a full interview with the guys from IMD coming up a little bit later on in this podcast. Malcolm was talking to them. But one of the things we've scored well on is trade. We were the 5th best trade hub in the world last year. Now we're the best. Numero uno, number one, it's Jebel Ali, it's Port Rashid, it's Dubai International Airport as well. But it's not just Dubai, this is the UAE, so it's things like the new port down at Kizad in Abu Dhabi. It's a lot of the ports on the west coast, Khor Fakkan, which is Sharjah, Fujairah as well. A lot of work going on in Ras Al Khaimah. That's a great one to know. Finally, one other story that both of us have been looking at, Brandy, but from different angles, is Uber, the ride-hailing company. The thing that caught my attention was the financials that we got from Uber overnight. They were really, really good, actually. It's had a lot of flak lately, Uber, but they've done really well. For example, revenue has up 67% quarter on quarter, $2.5 billion of revenue in the first 3 months of this year. That's a good number, and that has helped them slash their losses. They're still not making money, but the loss was much lower than last year, just $300 million. And the third bit of good financial news that Uber got was the valuation, $62 billion. There's a new round of funding going on, and the people who are buying into that are valuing the company at $62 billion. Remember, it was $70 billion about a year ago, then SoftBank bought into it at a valuation of just under $50 billion. Now it's back up again, yo-yoing a little bit. $62 billion for Uber. So I've been looking at the finances. You, Brandy, have been looking at the people.
Absolutely. More of a personnel story from my point of view. And this is because Uber is part of what's widely known as the gig economy. People making money, well, it's touted as being when you want to, working for yourself, etc., etc. Although people involved in the gig economy, largely in delivery, delivering food, whatever it happens to be, or working for companies like Uber as taxi drivers, would argue that you're not really working for yourself when you want to, because these people obviously have rules. Across Europe, there's been a bit of an argument, and it's gone through Parliament in different countries, about whether or not the people who work for the likes of Uber are freelancers or contractors, or whether they are actually employees. The sticking point tends to be around how much freedom you've got. What Uber has done is they've started to give sick pay, parental leave, medical cover, compensation for any injuries that you sustain at work, and bereavement payments to the people who work with them.
This sounds like good news, but the unions aren't happy, are they?
No, because I'm carefully saying with them rather than for them, because that's the difference between being a contractor or an employee. Now, the unions are suspicious. Some of them say, look, you'd already kind of bought in a bit of a sick pay or insurance cover package. This is just window dressing, really. You're just revamping a little bit to look good. Other people saying it doesn't go far enough. Certainly there's a bit of PR in here, because we know that Uber has a hearing, an appeal hearing next month in Westminster, because in London they've said they're going to withdraw Uber's operating license, and Uber obviously doesn't want that to happen. They're still operating until the appeal, but it could all disappear. So I'm sure there's an element of PR. The CEO of Uber, Dara Khosrowshahi, says, we've called our drivers partners, but we didn't always act like it. He says they've focused too much on growth and not enough on people. But the question is, well, I have two questions. A, will this really make a change? And B, if they admit that they are liable for things like sick pay, if Uber admits that it has this kind of responsibility, how far could it go? This could be a thin edge of the wedge for Uber. And we know, rightly or wrongly, and a lot of people think wrongly, one of the things that makes Uber competitive is that it doesn't have a workforce. It doesn't have to pay those people all the time.
It's the asset-light business model, isn't it? Now, let's get, talking of competitiveness, some more detail on our top story this morning on the Business Breakfast. This is IMD, the Swiss business school, and their annual competitiveness survey. This is the gold standard when it comes to competitiveness. To find out more about the UAE leaping up the rankings to seventh in the world, Malcolm spoke with the chief economist at IMD. He is Christos Kabolis. This is what he had to say about the UAE's ascent up the rankings.
There are some areas where UAE has done very, very nicely. This basically translates with the international trade and the international investment.
The UAE actually did rank number one globally for international trade, as you mentioned there, and that was up from fifth last year. What does that very flattering position actually represent?
Well, it represents one out of 20 sub-factors that we count in order to provide the final ranking. The final ranking is a very comprehensive measure that tries to give an indication of the ability of a country to manage the resources it has, the competencies of the economy, in order to produce sustainable value, and therefore to augment the prosperity of its citizens.
But in simple terms, does that mean we are the best place in the world for global trade, as far as you're concerned?
Indeed. The way that we measure the international trade, UAE was number one out of 63 economies that we study.
The UAE actually does score pretty well on most of the 20 criteria, as you would expect if our position has jumped up to seventh. But we have three weak spots, and they stand out. Health, we were in 46th position, education, 44th, and scientific infrastructure, 37th. Talk us through those areas. What does the UAE need to improve, really, to move up the rankings in those areas?
You very correctly pointed out these three areas, that all of them belong in the factor that we call infrastructure. So in essence, the UAE economy performs very well with respect to government efficiency. It performs very well with respect to business efficiency. And what it needs now is to improve on this third factor, which is infrastructure. So in essence, what needs to be done is to make investments that the returns will show up in the future. And maybe UAE has already started working on these areas. But all the dimensions of infrastructure, one characteristic that they have is, of course, that there is a lag time between starting an investment, starting working with a particular strategy that strengthens these components, and actually see the rewards being materialized with respect to numbers.
I can understand what you're saying in terms of education there and scientific infrastructure, but we sort of pride ourselves on our healthcare. We've got Healthcare City, we've got great hospitals, but yet we're in 46th place. What is affecting our health ranking?
The healthcare is private and it's not available for everybody. I can see here, for instance, that the expenditure on total health places the country at a quite low position with respect to the other 63 economies. When we're discussing about infrastructure within the health system, these are also numbers that UAE can improve upon substantially.
How has the introduction of VAT affected the UAE's competitiveness?
It's too early to see the results of that. The ranking of 2018 used this hard data from the previous year, from 2017, in order to have been completed. We don't have the hard data current year. The only thing that it is relevant with respect to the value-added tax is the perception of the people. And therefore, nothing has been identified strongly in the results from this particular undertaking.
In the last week, the UAE has announced plans to allow 100% foreign ownership of some onshore companies and 10-year visas for some professionals and investors. In broad terms, how do you rate the UAE government's track record when it comes to business-friendly policies?
It does very, very well with respect to the institutional framework, issues that are related with the cost of capital, with a central bank policy, and so on and so forth. UAE performs very well. The same is true with respect to business legislation. It is a business-friendly environment, also with respect to the tax policy. So an increase in the taxes, of course, no one likes taxes, as we know. Nevertheless, a very important component here is for the people who will pay the taxes to realize what these taxes will be used for. And this is a very important aspect.
Now, we were seventh place overall as the UAE. Looking globally, which countries came out above us and what can we learn from them here in the UAE?
The countries that were above UAE are United States, who was number one. Then we have Hong Kong and Singapore from Asia. And then we have three countries from Western Europe, Netherlands, Switzerland, and Denmark. Your question is very nice. I mean, what can we learn? And the issues that we learn are very, very broad, because something that comes out from our ranking is that there is not really one recipe that a country can use in order to improve the ranking. A country must have a comprehensive strategy that encompasses the natural resources that it has under its control, plus the cultural environment and the competencies that it has. So it is not just one recipe. In general, what we have seen are things like transparency is associated with high competitiveness rankings. So the more transparent an economy, the higher the competitiveness rankings. How open an economy is, this also is associated with high rankings. And how equal, the issue of equality comes very strongly with respect to competitiveness ranking.
Well, this is a competitiveness survey. At the moment, the US, as you said, there is in number one place, and they're in the middle of pulling out of free trade agreements. They're in the middle of trade wars, potential trade wars, embargoes, etc. Would you expect to see the US fall off the top spot for next year's ranking?
Difficult question, Malcolm. Allow me to surpass that. It's too early. We just came out with this year's rankings. We need to study this first, and then we can say what happens in the future. However, we can say that issues related to taxes always affect perceptions. This improves competitiveness. Now, it's true that, as you said, allegedly, there is a lot of discussion about trade wars and moving out of trade agreements and so on and so forth. But nevertheless, these have not been completely materialized yet. So we'll have to wait and see.
Thank you very much for talking to The Business Breakfast. Dr. Christos Kabolis, the IMD World Competitiveness Council Chief Economist. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Malcolm. Have a wonderful day.
This is The Business Breakfast.
Stay one step ahead with Dubai Eye 103.8.
One of our guests this morning was actually in by popular demand. A couple of days ago, we were discussing a new app here in the UAE called Tenirit. It's an app that allows you to rent or borrow items rather than shell out and buy them. When we were talking about it on the show at the beginning of the week, we got so many texts in from people wanting to know how to spell it, how to download it, how to get involved, really interested in the business model. So we thought we would go straight to the source. We've been speaking this morning to Ali Ibrahim Al Abbas. Now, he is one of the co-founders of Tenirit, and I will spell that for you if you want to download it, T-N-E-R-I-T. To find out all about whether we could really see a proper sharing economy taking place here in the UAE. Ali's been telling us how it all works.
After completing my master's degree, I was researching for a new venture to start. I started to study some patterns of current businesses and came to realize the significance of the sharing economy, and particularly P2P renting of goods, which is an untapped market.
And you've set this up with your brother, haven't you?
Yes, my brother Hussein Al Abbas is the co-founder.
What's it, just as an aside before we get into the actual business, what's it like working with your brother?
I think it's an amazing experience. I mean, there's no one else I'd rather work with, to be honest. And I mean, so far so good, yeah.
So the basic idea of Tenirit is that you rent or even borrow items off other people rather than buying them yourself. How does it physically work?
Basically, you can either be a borrower or a lender. As a borrower, you can browse various items that are listed by lenders. You can check availability and place a rent request. Once the lender accepts your rent request, we have a built-in messaging service that gets activated. You can chat to discuss item drop-off, pickup, location, etc.
And how do you guys get paid? What's the business model?
Tenirit charges the lender and borrower rental fee. And that's how we cover our operating costs.
So each time something gets rented out, yes, you get a little bit as well?
Yes, that's right. It's a transaction fee.
How much? The sort of things are available. Maxi cozy car seat available for 10 dirhams a day. Jawbone speaker, 12 dirhams a day. Yeah. Or the book Economics, A User's Guide by Ha Jun Chang, 7 dirhams a day. How much do you make out of that? I mean, the figures aren't very big. So you take a little bit from the person who owns and the person who's renting. How much do you get exactly?
We get 18%. So that's 11% from the borrower and 7% from the lender.
So you're taking from both ends?
From both ends, yeah.
That's interesting because most businesses and most sites, if I think of things like, I don't know, renting a house, whatever it happens to be, will take from just one or the other.
Can I just clarify that then? That sort of 100 dirhams, you take 18 of the 100?
Yes.
Why are you taking from both ends?
Each party is using the app for a specific reason. I mean, lenders can list their items for free, but obviously we have to cover our operating costs, which means that we have to take a transaction fee. And borrowers get to use the platform by borrowing stuff that are cheap instead of actually buying them.
What's gone in to setting up Tenirit? How have you built it?
That's a good question. I think it's one of the main important questions. Tenirit has been a very challenging journey. To be honest, it's a very, very sophisticated app. We've built it from scratch. We didn't have a business model to look at and replicate. It took us a lot of time. It is basically two apps in one. So you can either be on borrower mode or you can be on lender mode. We've tried to maximize the benefits for lenders and borrowers in the first version. So as a lender, you can manage your listings. So you can set a price per day. You can set discount pricing, rent notice, maximum, minimum rent duration. You can also block a date. You have access to your stats, your earnings, how many views your items received, and you can actually withdraw from your account balance.
The sort of things we just mentioned there, the car seat, the book, the speaker, low value products as well. How are the goods and the money changed hands?
The price of the items that are listed is, first of all, it's entirely up to the lender. So, for example, if I own a camera and I list it on Tenirit and I put the camera for 50 dirhams a day, and then I have my friend who puts it for 20 dirhams, the likelihood of someone renting it from my friend would be higher, provided that my friend's rating is as high as mine, for example.
Is that suggesting it's a bidding war?
It's a marketplace. So it's fairly competitive.
So how does the money change hands? Do I pay the person I'm renting something from directly, or does the money come via you, is what I'm asking?
The money goes through our payment gateway.
Ah.
So you can only pay through your debit or credit card.
And what happens to the money that you're holding?
The money that we're holding comes to our account.
Yes, and then what do you do with
that? The payment gateway.
Yeah. No, not the 18 dirhams out of the 100. I'm talking about the whole amount. So obviously, if you've got a whole bunch of transactions going on, you might build up quite a lump of cash in your own bank account if everything comes through you.
No, nothing comes to our bank account. It goes to the payment gateway. So
and then straight on.
What about insurance? What happens if I borrow your camera and I break it?
Yes, currently, borrowers are liable for any damage caused to the lender's item. It is important to note here that one of the main pillars of the sharing economy is building trust. And trust doesn't come that easy. So we're trying to develop trust, which is why we have a very, very secure verification process for users. Basically, Tenarit is a trusted, closed community.
But what recourse would I have if someone did? I mean, if I lent this mythical camera to Malcolm, for example, and he broke it, I know where he lives, I know where he works. You know, I have a bit of recourse. I can put some social pressure on him. But someone over an app, I mean, is there any enforcement that I could get them to pay up?
You have the built-in messaging service. You can share your number. You can discuss that with Malcolm. Currently, it's not part of what we do. But we have an insurance plan in the pipeline to be introduced in version 2, hopefully.
The question I've been asking myself about the app, and I am going to download it later, is would I drive even a short distance to rent low capital items such as the ones we've talked about earlier? Probably not, but I would for higher cost items, perhaps a hedge trimmer or a sanding machine or something that I would only use rarely and I didn't want to shell out to buy because it would become a dust gatherer in the garage. Something like, you know, I would only use 5 days out of 360, for instance. How does the exchange of goods take part? I mean, for you know, how would you change a book? I mean, how does it get from A to B? Does somebody have to drive halfway across town to change a book that you're renting for 7 dirhams?
Yes, I mean, currently on version 1, the exchange has to happen between the lender and the borrower. We plan to introduce a delivery service in the next few versions.
But to be fair enough, I mean, if you go and buy a second-hand good off any of the second-hand sites, you're driving over and picking it up?
Yeah, and it's important to note that there's a benefit to this. You can actually get to know the person. The person can actually explain how to use the camera.
And you know what they look like if they break the camera.
Tenerit, T-N-E-R-I-T. How did you come up with the name? What does it mean?
We wanted something unique. T-N-E-R means rent.
Backwards.
Opposite way around, backwards. Mm-hmm. And it, so rent it.
How big could the items are gone here get? We're getting a number of questions in on our text message system asking about things like cars.
That's a very good question. Currently, we do not have cars and we do not intend to introduce cars on Tenerit.
That's a shame.
I mean, there are very many other apps who actually have car rentals available. We do not plan to introduce this anytime soon, at least.
Are there rules around it?
In what sense?
As in legislation around who can rent a car to whom here in the UAE?
I'm not quite sure. I mean, we haven't got into that. And it's important to note that the maximum price per day is 2,000 dirhams.
For anything?
For any item, per day.
Are people putting things like apartments and houses on the app?
No.
Would you allow it?
Each and every listing goes through an approval process. So we approve each and every listing.
Right, so people couldn't rent out Airbnb-style their flat for a couple of days.
Exactly, you cannot.
You mentioned a sort of limit of 2,000 dirhams. What is either on the site at the moment or what do you envisage being on the site that would attract 2,000 dirhams a day? What sort of things?
I mean, let's say a 30,000 dirham camera might be worth putting it for 2,000 dirhams.
Yeah.
It's also important to note that the maximum rent duration is 90 days currently, so that's 3 months. We plan to increase that in the near future.
You need, the one thing I see looking at the app and having had a play with it is that it's going to rely on critical mass. You're obviously just getting started and I can see that a few items are being added every day since I've downloaded it. What are you going to do to try and get the critical mass so that it is as useful as it can be?
We're going to try and educate people about the benefits of the app. I mean, aside from your salary that you receive from your daily job, this is something that you can actually earn on the side. So, for example, if you have limited storage space or if you have a lot of items that are sitting down there idle, you can actually earn something out of them rather than wasting them.
Thanks very much for joining us on the Business Breakfast this morning. Ali Ibrahim Al Abbas is the co-founder of Tenerit, and that is spelt T-N-E-R-I-T. We've had a number of people asking how to spell it, so they can download it. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
This is the Business Breakfast.
Stay one step ahead with Dubai Eye 103.8.
Another story we've really loved this morning is what Hilton, the hotel people, are doing. Hilton are the latest to join the war on plastic. Hilton has declared that in this region, it's going to get rid of straws. It wants us all sipping rather than sucking, but it also wants us sipping rather than gulping as well, because they are launching a much more difficult, or at least in my opinion, war on plastic bottles. If you think when you check into a hotel, or if you're in a business meeting that takes place in a hotel ballroom, or even just attending an event or a trade show, how many small plastic bottles you see around the place that are just there waiting for you as part of the hospitality, part of the courtesy. Hilton says that has to go. We've been speaking this morning to William Costley. He's the Vice President of Operations for this region, the Arabian Peninsula and Turkey, for Hilton. And he came in to explain what the hotel chain was up to.
We just actually recently announced, Chris Nassetta, our CEO, that by 2030 that we will be actually halving our carbon emissions globally, and similarly at the same time doubling the amount of aid that we provide globally as well. And similarly giving our team members an opportunity to participate with 10 million man hours of volunteer work as well. And throughout that also we did make an announcement of a global ban on plastic straws that will take place, and that's obviously something that is in the news. But to be honest with you, it's not just about straws, it's about plastic in general.
Which is what we were just saying. The straws is great, and we've seen a number of restaurants do it here locally. But the thing that really grabbed me as being ambitious was removing plastic bottles from meeting rooms and events, because we're a bit addicted to them, particularly here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Our Europe, Middle East and Africa region, which I'm part of, we've made a commitment to get rid of plastic bottles from all our meeting rooms by the end of this year. So it is a tall order, because as you quite rightly say, they are culturally there, and if you don't have them, people say why they're not there. But quite honestly, it's the right thing to do. If you imagine in 2016, they reckoned 460 billion plastic bottles were sold, and one of them takes 450 years to biodegrade. So it's a massive global issue that affects everyone.
Do you know how many you get through here?
Our goal is annually it will be approximately 20 million less plastic bottles consumed in our hotels in Europe, Middle East and Africa.
And what are you putting in as an alternative?
What we actually did, we had a regional meeting in February where we actually banned plastic bottles. So we gave everyone a BPA bottle. We had large containers at the side and just people filled them as they went. So basically we had no plastic bottles at all, not just in the meeting room, but in the bedrooms as well. Because, you know, meeting rooms is a big thing, but also bedrooms is another thing.
Which was going to be my next question. Every hotel I've ever checked into has had at least two complimentary bottles of water, and they just keep arriving and arriving and arriving. Will you eventually target that?
Absolutely. Because this is a war on plastic. If I give you an example, I've just arrived 6 months. My previous region, I looked after Southeast Asia and India. And in Thailand as a country, we actually get rid of plastic bottles from our hotels. We replaced them with glass bottles, and we will continue to challenge, subject to availability in a country, or what is the alternative.
Looking at some of the other measures that you can take to achieve Chris Nassetta's goal of being carbon neutral, or getting there by 2030, one of the issues is air conditioning. And still, when I check into a hotel in this region, it's set to 19, 20 or 21 degrees. Now we know, because we've had countless hoteliers like you join us saying it should be 24 degrees. That will reduce the carbon footprint of a hotel dramatically. And yet it's not happening. I checked into one hotel 2 weeks ago. I was freezing when I walked in and the AC was at 19 degrees.
Yeah.
How's that war going?
You know, with technology, you have building management systems that can preset pre-arrival temperatures. So, and one another thing, obviously, which is important is education for the room attendants as well. So we have both building management systems where we can pre-set the climate. Look, 23 degrees is an actual comfortable temperature.
Okay, I'll give you 1 degree.
I'll give you
23 is better than 19.
But one is education, and two is the, you know, culture of people as well. You know, when they come to hotels, you know, maybe they'll set it much colder than maybe with the wood at home as well. So it's educating customers, it's educating our team members.
It's like an all-you-can-eat buffet. You think, well, I'm not paying for this AC, so I'll crank it to 19, 16 degrees.
Yeah, I mean, listen, at the end of the day, our job is to make sure it's a ambient temperature when you arrive, but then after that, as you know, rightly, the customer pays and we'll set it what they feel is right. We also have motion sensors in rooms, so actually when guests are out, they're actually, the technology takes over and reduces it to the ambient temperature again.
You're also declaring a bit of a war on soap.
Yeah.
Trying to get to zero hotel soap sent to landfill. And of course, you go into a new hotel room, you unwrap a package of soap, packaging, you use it for the day and a half that you're there, and then you're gone. What are you going to do with the soap?
Actually, across the world, we do many things, and we've recycled millions of bars of soap all over the globe. We have many different ways that we do that. In some countries, it gets consolidated in a particular area, and then it gets redistributed to underdeveloped countries, or which we have done with some of our strategic partners, in particular in Asia, where we actually have soap-making machines in our hotels. We actually sanitize, break it down, make new bars of soap, and give them out to local communities.
What can you do about the tiny little bottles of shampoo and conditioner and shower gel and the rest of it?
First of all,
most
the packaging, you can rightfully consume them where you want, you've paid for them. But ultimately, the first and foremost thing is that it's a biodegradable container, right? Because ultimately, when it goes to landfill, it must be sustainable. So that's the first thing that we, you know, aspire everywhere, is that it's biodegradable. The second thing is that we're actually doing some piloting where instead of the small 50 mil, we'll actually put in larger containers, especially at shower areas, and a dispenser, which ultimately will reduce the amount of small bottles and similarly at the same time reduce landfill.
I get how the dispensers might work in some of your, I think you'd call them limited service hotels. Mm-hmm. We probably call them 3 or 4 star hotels.
Yeah.
But can that work in some of your flagship hotels like a Conrad or a Waldorf Astoria?
Funny you should say that. One in the Conrad in Koh Samui, for example, and the Conrad in the Maldives, we do have larger dispensers that are very... They're made of ceramic.
Brandy, I think we should go into some fact-finding. This is a very important story.
They were ceramic dispensers, and they have got high-quality amenities inside them. So we do it in some locations. It makes sense, especially in resorts and in islands, where you don't want any plastic or biodegradable to be there. And our Hilton flagship full-service chain, as well as DoubleTree, will be putting in larger dispensers for pilot.
Last question from me. This is all lovely, but you guys are a business. What does it do to your bottom line?
That's a very good question. If you take, for example, the straws and the bottles that we've done, most likely that will be an increased cost because plastic is the cheapest form at this moment in time. So that is the case. When it comes to the environment in general, there's always large multi-million dollar investments up front. So for example, for air conditioning, BMS systems, putting in a technology that long term will reduce the carbon footprint, but there's a lot of capital cost up front. The same with lights. You know, an LED to convert a building might be thousands of light bulbs. You might have to invest $150,000 to change them, and it'll take you maybe 2 years to get your money back. But the underlining and most important fact is it's the right thing to do, and we must protect our planet for not just our children, but our children's children.
William Costley, the Vice President of Operations in the Arabian Peninsula and Turkey for Hilton, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. We hope you have a cracking weekend. We, of course, will be back on air and with our new podcast on Sunday.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.